Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this, the August 16, 2009 edition of Ford Forum. I'm your host, John Quinlan, and our guest in an interview I taped this past Thursday is attorney Frederick Hertz, co-author with Emily Daskow of Making It Legal, a guide to same-sex marriage, domestic partnerships, and civil unions. And today's discussion of the evolving struggle for same-sex marriage should prove to be a thought-provoking topic, one that hits close to home for many of our listeners and the friends and family members they care about. Earlier this summer, the governor signed an historic law creating a domestic partnership registry and associated new rights for same-sex couples. August 3rd was a busy day at county clerk's offices all across Wisconsin as same-sex couples lined up early to register. And 2 days ago, on Friday, same-sex couples renewed their commitments at a beautiful ceremony at the Capitol. Given the many legal challenges and legislative battles that lie ahead, no one knows exactly what path this all may take. Our guest, Fred Hertz, is an Oakland-based attorney who will provide many insights and valuable advice, helping us to explore the current confusing, crazy quilt of laws affecting same-sex couples nationwide. A native of Minnesota, he proudly points to the pioneering role for legal recognition of LGBT families that's long been played right here in the Midwest. He also comes at this issue with a fresh approach, resonant with his own decision not to marry, despite his 27-year-long same-sex partnership. The notion that marriage may not be for everybody, and that's a discussion with relevance to couples and individuals, both gay and straight. Regardless, though, he believes in the power of entering into any partnership with eyes wide open and clear understandings about how finances, caretaking, and other issues will be handled, and the fact that gay people, in forging creative new solutions to these challenges, may even have a few things to teach their straight counterparts about the meanings behind marriage and other partnership agreements. And now on with the show. We're speaking with Frederick Hertz, and he's the author of Making It Legal, a guide to same-sex marriage, domestic partnerships, and civil unions, and he's joining us from out in Oakland.
Thanks so much for calling.
All right, thanks for joining us today. This is something that is very much on people's minds here in Wisconsin. With recent passage of domestic partnership legislation, with neighboring Iowa now accepting gay marriage. But what I think is interesting about some of the thesis in the book is, of course, this is a time of great celebration. And yet, one of the things I think that you really bring out is marriage may not be for everybody. Why is that something that's important for people to consider?
Well, one of the things that has been an odd feature of this battle is that it has become a civil rights battle. And so the whole tenor has been kind of, we gay people against you straight people, we want benefits, we want rights. And what there has not been enough attention paid is that actually marriage is a lot about responsibilities. And it's actually not a we issue. When people often ask me, is it a good thing to get married? I often say, well, it depends if you're the rich one or the poor one. For the, you know, and there are a lot of straight guys who have become very anti-marriage because they now see it means paying alimony. So what I'm trying to say to people is that everyone should have the right to marry, but the right to marry is not the duty to marry. And what you have to figure out after you've gained the right, either to get marriage or marriage equivalent or marriage light, as whatever is appropriate in your state, you need to be thinking about, is this the right arrangement for us?
Very often this discussion doesn't occur in terms of the realities that some of these relationships may not last, may dissolve. And so it's really especially important going into this to know what could happen on the other end, especially with this patchwork quilt of different laws in different jurisdictions.
Yeah. One of the things I try to convey to people is, first of all, every relationship does come to an end. Except, I suppose, if you're a deeply devout Mormon, they believe it's to all eternity.
Uh-huh.
But they all end either in death or dissolution. And so you actually can't avoid the ending. What you can do is plan for a gentle, more caring ending. And I predict, and I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of, that far more than 50% of all same-sex marriages will end in dissolution. And I say that simply because we have a higher percentage of relationships without kids, we have a higher percentage of late relationships, and we have a community that is actually more tolerant of dissolution as a positive evolution of relationships. They are not stigmatized by being a failed marriage. So I think it's actually okay to say, more likely than not, we will break up. So let's do it in a way that's considerate. I also find that going through the process of figuring out what's mine, what's yours, what debts are shared, actually addresses issues that brings people together. So I think this is really the umbrella that keeps you dry, not the umbrella that causes the rain to happen.
You were alluding earlier to the term marriage light. I've heard that brought up in the context of different options now that are present in France.
Yeah.
And actually many heterosexual couples taking advantage of that civil union marriage light option. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that and why marriage light may be the right solution for some folks?
Yes. The French example is a very interesting one because France has extremely rigid inheritance rules. You actually cannot disinherit your children, for example. You cannot disinherit your spouse. So if, for example, there's someone who has children and does not want their assets to go to their spouse, wants them to go to their children from a prior relationship, they may want to avoid marriage, and for them, civil union, which is what the French is called, might be right for them. The other is that, for example, if you have a partner that has a very high-risk business, or you have a partner that has a history of gambling debts, you might want the powers of attorney, you might want the medical care without having the joint liability for debts. And you know, one of the things, John, that's problematic is that up until very recently, marriage was an unmodifiable, non-modifiable package. Up until a few decades ago, there weren't even prenups allowed. You took the whole package or you took none of it. And one of the things that has actually made marriage more appealing to same-sex couples, frankly, is that it has become more flexible, and you actually can, through prenups, through different forms of registration, customize your legal relationship in a way that works best for the two of you. And I really encourage people to do that in a way that, I must say, requires a level of education, sophistication, and emotional openness, because to actually sit around and say, well, if we divorce, this is what you get, and if you die, this is what you get, is not a simple conversation at all.
You were joking early on in the book that among some of the people you know that you're often branded as the anti-marriage lawyer, and the sense that I got it is you're the proceed with caution lawyer. So this whole idea of prenuptial agreements, I think we're familiar from celebrity context in terms of folks who have a disproportionate amount of wealth on one side of the equation trying to protect themselves. But this really does have some very practical applications, and as you said, in terms of being open to maybe just very real differences in ways of viewing the world or doing things among partners. So, for example,
right,
if you have one partner who's very frugal and another partner that maybe really is an impulse buyer,
yes,
you know, this is a way to build some balance into that.
Yes. Now, one of the things that gets complicated, in fact, I just was on the phone this morning with some folks and another lawyer, there are situations where people have been together 10, 15 years where they weren't legally registered or married. They couldn't be 15 years ago. And now they also do not have the federal exemptions on tax reasons, on tax issues, that they would if they were in a heterosexual marriage. And I'm actually in the process of doing an agreement where my client wants to give his partner more than he would be legally entitled to because they only recently registered, and they need to do it in a way that avoids double taxation. So this is an example where if they had been an opposite-sex couple and had gotten married in the first year of their time together, they wouldn't need a post-nup or a prenup. But it's really because of the legal contours of their lives that they need it in a way that a straight couple wouldn't. And that's one of the things I'm trying to convey to people, is that because of the legal complexity, you might actually need an agreement to achieve your real goals because the law may not cover you. And that's especially true, by the way, if you live in a state like Wisconsin or Minnesota that does not have marital rights. If you actually want to say, I want to provide a safety net for my partner should we break up, you need to do that in a cohabitation agreement because the law won't provide that in the absence of marriage.
Well, you're also wading into something that's important, I think, to emphasize at the outset, that as great as it was for that shining moment that California was able to achieve marriage victory, hopefully the ones that will be retained in New England and Iowa that really isn't marriage yet, because so many of the protections under marriage are these 1,400 things plus that are contained under federal law.
But no, you're wrong, John. I must disagree.
Okay.
Under state law, domestic partnership in California is basically identical to marriage.
Okay.
Just as civil union in New Jersey is identical to marriage. And even in the six states that have marriage, there is no federal recognition. So right now, the marriage equivalent states, like California, putting aside the indignity of not being able to call it marriage, in terms of legal rules, they are the same as the marriage states, both in the provision of state law and the lack of protection under federal law.
Okay.
So those are really in the same, you're in the same boat whether you're marriage or marriage equivalent. The real problem is all of those groups, the marriage and the marriage equivalent, are denied federal benefits.
And that's a distinction I was trying to make.
Yeah,
right.
Yes. Okay. They are all, but even those where it's full marriage are still denied federal benefits.
Right. And so it's important to go into it realizing that there are still extraordinary things that a heterosexual couple that has that federal recognition takes for granted that a same-sex couple needs to do.
Well, you say needs to do. Again, I must disagree.
Sure.
Most of the federal benefits cannot be accommodated for by private agreement.
Okay.
The state benefits, things like inheritance or medical powers of attorney, those can be addressed through private documents.
All right.
The federal benefits, getting your partner Social Security if your partner should die, getting a passport or getting an immigration for your foreign lover, no amount of private documentation can address the federal benefits. Most of the, as far as I know, the federal benefits are all government bestowed, and only an act of Congress or a reversal by the U.S. Supreme Court will remedy that problem. No amount of good lawyering can solve those federal problems.
No, and you're right in being this precise on language in a case like this. I guess what I mean is, I guess you should certainly be aware of the fact that you are,
yes,
without these protections. So, for example, for a co-parent here in Wisconsin whose relationship to their child isn't legally recognized, they need to realize that that child and the event of their death isn't going to get Social Security.
Correct.
So maybe something
Correct.
Compensating in terms of additional life insurance
Correct.
Or other things.
Correct. And yes, and part of the thing that I find makes this so hard for couples is, and this was sort of my big realization in writing the book, heterosexual couples have no lack of problems. You know, as we all know, they have emotional issues, they have financial issues, they have parentage issues, but they are facing those issues on a ground plane that is more like, I should say, Wisconsin, which is the earth stays in the same place year to year, it doesn't move.
Mm-hmm.
In same-sex couples, you're always in earthquake country because your underlying ground plane changes from state to state, from year to year. And so part of what is so hard for people, and we actually did a whole chapter in the book just on the decision-making process because we find that so complicated, is that where you have your interpersonal romantic relationship issues being played out on a ground plane or a foundation that itself is changing from year to year or state to state, it makes decision-making incredibly difficult.
Could you give us a couple of examples of that, especially folks that are maybe moving from one state to another?
Sure,
state?
Sure. I met with a couple months ago. They live in California. One of them is unemployed. He's looking for a job. He was considering taking a job in Utah or in New Hampshire. At the time we were meeting, New Hampshire did not allow marriage. California did. This was last fall. And so this is a couple who has their own relationship issues. Are we really getting ready to be married? They've had some ups and downs in their relationship. One of them has some bad financial records. So they have those issues. But now we're trying to figure out, well, what if they move to Utah where their marriage would not be recognized? Mm. What if they move to Massachusetts or New Hampshire where it would be recognized? And how do they make a decision in the fall of 2008 that will work for them going into 2009, going into Utah, going into New Hampshire? And in the end, I have to say, after we had this very long and thorough discussion of all the options, my advice to them was to wait to see what state they were going to live in to make the decision then. A month later, they wrote back to me and said they just couldn't wait. They've gone ahead and gotten married. They will deal with another state once they move. But that was a perfect example where they had all the personal issues, but then they had all the legal change issues to deal with.
Right. So it's a dynamic situation in terms of people
Absolutely.
Being informed consumers about all this.
Yes.
Before we go into the first break, there are a couple of things that I think have come up here in Wisconsin, being a state that has some protections, not others. But for that couple, for example, that has decided to go to Canada or to go to Iowa, one of the cautions that's been put out there is that we happen to have a law, I think going back to 1915 or thereabouts, that imposes a penalty on folks who purposefully flaunt the marriage laws.
Yes, you have what's called the marriage evasion statute. Delaware has it as well.
Are there folks who are being prosecuted under those circumstances?
I'm not aware of any prosecution. By the way, those laws were not put in for gay people. They were primarily put in for underage marriage.
Right.
So that if somebody wanted to marry a 14-year-old at a time when, I don't know, Alabama allowed 14-year-olds to marry, you couldn't rush off with your 14- or 15-year-old girlfriend and marry in Alabama. That's what those laws were put in place in. I don't think we're going to have a problem with that. The bigger problem, and I try to use either humor or metaphors to give people a sense of it, is that if Wisconsin should follow the line of a lot of states to say that divorce is a form of recognition because it's a court sanctioning of your relationship, you could find yourself not able to get a divorce. And to me, the only thing worse than not being able to get married would be not able to get divorced.
Yeah.
And because there are residency rules for divorce that there aren't for marriage, you could find yourself having to move to Canada for up to a year to divorce or move to Iowa. And, you know, most people's lives, whether it's because of their kids or their jobs or their homes, can't afford to just move to another state for that purpose.
You're anticipating that my next question, which was that. So is it, for example, in Canada, it's at least a year that you have to maintain residency, I think?
I believe in all provinces it's a year.
Yeah.
Some states only have six-month rules. California has only a six-month rule. But at the moment, you can't get a divorce of a Canadian marriage in California, so California doesn't work for you. The other piece, which is that if you should marry outside of your state, the interpersonal issue is, well, are you considering yourself married for purposes of property or parentage? So what we are saying to people, and I do feel like I'm somewhat shouting into the wind here, is that if you are going to reject our advice and go ahead and do it, at least have a private agreement that says, should we ever break up, our property will be divided up as if we were married, or not, as you so desire, so that at least you're not in a situation where one person is saying, I'm entitled to half the house, and the other one is saying, no, you're not, where you have, and this is very touchy, you have a lesbian or gay person hiding behind the homophobic law and say, guess what, na-na-na-na-na, you don't get my house because we weren't really married. You might think that's not right or morally fair of a gay person to do that, but you know what? People do.
In the heat of dissolution of a relationship, you know, it's something that when I was director of community center, we saw quite often, unfortunately, and it is a reality. But I think it comes back to your basic assertion that that's why it's important to be upfront about all of this and be in agreement of it going into a relationship. So
yeah. The other piece is that if you can't get a dissolution, you can't repartner legally with someone else. So if you actually do break up, and this is a problem we see a lot of here, is you have people who now want to register for health insurance payer purposes, for all sorts of purposes, and they have never terminated their prior domestic partnership or marriage. Well, that would make their new marriage a bigamist one,
yeah,
and not legally valid. So it can be a real problem if it's not taken care of in advance.
All right. Again, we're speaking with the author of Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions. Frederick Kurtz is on the line from out in Oakland. He has written this book with his co-author, Emily Daskow. As you can tell, we're talking about a patchwork of regulations in different places, different implications as people move back and forth, and situation very much in flux. Again, all the more reason to keep in touch in this situation. This book is just now out, just been updated, talking about some of these new realities. And, Fred, what was that website address again?
www.makingitlegal.net. One of the things I want to tell people is that both Emily and I have blogs, and NOLO has an update. You can access all those from the website. And so, for example, one of my second blog is on Wisconsin. We held the book's publication to include Iowa and Vermont and California's Prop 8 decision, but we completely understand that things are changing month by month, so through the blog site and through NOLO's updates, people will be able to get the up-to-date legal information.
All right. Mentioning NOLO, as I told you, we had an interview just on a book called The Sharing Solution. NOLO is one of these presses that's notorious for good consumer information and providing that extra backup to the websites, too. So it's a great place for all this information.
Thank you, Seth. Thanks for the plug.
All right. Again, this is Forward Forum. We'll be back in just a moment. Hi, welcome back to Forward Forum. John Quinlan here. Our special Pride Weekend taped edition of the show, and we hope you'll enjoy our fascinating guest. It's our guest, Frederick Kurtz. He's an attorney in Oakland, California, and the author of Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions. Just off of what we were talking about going into the break, one very Wisconsin-specific other item I wanted to get into, and I don't know if you've had a chance to track this. Back in November of 2006, the voters here, by a margin of 59%, did pass a constitutional amendment. And it was in two parts, essentially. One that prohibited gay marriage, or said the marriage was between a woman and a man. But a second part that said that there was a prohibition on any legislation that would enact something similar to marriage.
Yes. So you have what's called sort of a super... We refer to those as superdomas.
Okay. And then since then, this has initially gone to court, was tossed out, now is going to be back before the Wisconsin Supreme Court again. And since then, of course, our state legislature has passed domestic partner benefits. Has that path been followed in other states? Do we have any sense of where that might lead?
Well, yes, and it's not a good answer. Michigan had a similar dynamic, and the Superdoma, I believe, was upheld, and there also have been similar battles around, again, in Michigan, around the university extending benefits. So I think that I'm concerned that as positive as the Michigan legislative action has been, it may well fall aground if there is a challenge on the grounds that it violates the superdoma aspects of marriage equivalent. I'm hoping that the Wisconsin courts will do the right thing and carve out that exception, as the California courts did. California courts addressed this very same issue and said that giving people the rights and duties of marriage is not giving them marriage and therefore is not a conflict. And the California state domestic partnership, which is actually even stronger than Wisconsin's, has upheld court challenge. But it's a very iffy situation.
Yeah, and we can't second guess. I just have to see where it plays out. But I think you did make an important distinction between California's law and ours. Ironically, the thing that may win the case for us is that our DP laws aren't seen as being very substantially similar to marriage.
Correct. It's really by having a reduced scope, you more clearly avoid the accusation of being a marriage equivalent. Okay. I will never call Wisconsin marriage equivalent, so they won't be able to cite my book to say that it's marriage equivalent.
Right. Well, I think what's useful at this stage is to go into maybe a little bit of a history of, in general, kind of the flow of how our struggle for rights has gone forward, and in terms of where marriage has fit into all of this. You tell a very interesting story. I think we mentioned on air, I can't remember, but you know that you're from Minnesota originally, and growing up as an 18-year-old, you attended a very interesting meeting back at that time.
Oh, it was great. It was, you know, I wasn't so sure of my own sexuality, but my
sister. It's circa 1969, I should say. I'm sorry.
Exactly. My sister and I went to a meeting of Free Fight Repression of Erotic Expression. I love that name. And I'm always having to correct these Californians and New Yorkers who think that all liberation, you know, started from the coast and went inland.
Yes.
They forget that there actually was a lot of liberation work being done in Madison, in Minneapolis, in Chicago, and places like that. And what was so clear then, and this is the contrast between the Fight Repression of Erotic Expression and what Jack Baker was trying to do. He's the Minnesotan who attempted to marry his lover. By the way, they're still together 40 years later. There really was a dominant sense in the gay culture that we are happily unmarried. We are free of the heteronormative rules. In fact, one of my favorite memories is, this was actually later in Austin, Texas, where there was a protest against Anita Bryant, and one of the big posters said, 2, 4, 6, 8, we don't overpopulate. You really have to go back in history to understand, you know, the nuances of that.
Yeah.
But there was a sense that we are outside the norm, we are happily outside the norm, and we want to stay outside the norm. And it really was, and in my experience, the evolution of both AIDS in gay men and the baby boom among lesbians, where you started to have increasing numbers of people say, well, wait a second. Being outside the norm has some real problems. Access to health care, access to decision making, access to my children, and the whole sort of what I call the romance of the margins began to look a little less picturesque. So you started to have a real shift, not in the totality of the gay community, but in the overall group, where people were starting to say, we want health insurance, we want benefits, we want legal protections, we want parentage over our children. And at first, and in fact there was a big debate in Lambda Legal Defense around 15 years ago about whether that should be obtained through marriage versus alternative means. There was a very strong faction that said we should fight for separate domestic partnership, we should fight for adoption without marriage, and that marriage was just too burdened by the sort of accretion of social values, social culture, and was too heteronormative in terms of husband's roles and wife's roles, that we should be seeking alternative means of protection, not marriage. And what's interesting is that among the gay activists and gay legal leaders, many of whom are friends who I respect greatly, they were almost totally against marriage. There was a very strong consensus that we should look to alternatives. And it really was among more, I should actually say, working class, on the streets, grassroots, more traditional gay and lesbian people, not activists, not lawyers, who were fighting for marriage. One of my favorite stories is I was on the Oprah show in 1996 when she had the show on marriage, and there was the New York couple that was trying to get married, and we were sitting in the green room and talking before, and I said, well, what do you think of all this? He said, well, you know, we're not going to let a bunch of, you know, fancy lawyers tell us that we can't marry. That's what we want. And when I said to them, well, how long have you lived together? They said, oh, we're waiting until we get married. We wouldn't think of living together before marriage.
Interesting.
That's how traditional they were.
Wow.
And they really resented the idea that the sort of fancy lawyers were telling them, hold off, don't ask for marriage, it's the wrong solution, because they wanted that very traditional umbrella and protection and social conventionality of marriage.
Yeah.
And I have to say, you know, they have turned out to be the vanguard of the majority.
Well, you know, and as you describe me, I think you're talking about something very real in terms of a dynamic tension there between folks that, again, as you kind of identify, are more traditional, more hey, you know, why shouldn't we have what our heterosexual neighbors have, and the folks that were more legalistic, maybe more academic, and they're thinking about
and more activist.
Yeah. But I think on the other hand, I think in my experience living with a very activist, very aware lesbian family that did want all of the things that other folks had, did want that for their child, I think sometimes it was a false dichotomy, because I would just, you know, as a parenting magazine editor, I remember doing the first comprehensive article, and it seemed like someone like Irva Shived, who I have great respect for, you know, she was making the point, we shouldn't join this institution before we thoroughly critique it. But I think the problem was, what folks were hearing was, you're underestimating how much we have critiqued it. And a lot of the lesbian families that I know went into this, went in with eyes wide open, with all of the faults of marriage known, and the gender dynamics, and the horrible history of oppression that follows it. So I think in some ways it's two streams that have kind of come together and embraced the strengths of both schools of thought.
Yes, although I must say, when I met with my first gay couple, where I was a mediator, where when I asked, well, what led to this dissolution? And one of the gay men said he broke his vows of fidelity and monogamy. I never thought I would hear those words coming out of a gay man.
Right. Well, actually, let's explore that just a little bit. You know, we have a mixed audience, so I think this is something that some of our straight listeners are learning about our community. And you know, one of the aspects of liberation was to break free and to break free of assumptions and to be able to construct, you know, relationships, you know, without an assumption like monogamy,
right, or gender roles. One of the things I think that is very upsetting to a lot of traditional married folks is to see how a marriage works where you can't assign the roles based on gender.
Yeah.
And you do have men raising children. You do have women working like husbands. And you do have open relationships. I recently met with a lesbian couple who said, you know, we actually do have a third person in our lives, and that third person is part of our family, and that third person is a sometimes romantic, sometimes domestic partner. And how do we do that in a way that honors that relationship, and yet we also want these marital benefits? It's a very challenging dynamic. You also have the question, whether it comes to monogamy or finance or gender roles, is what are the assumptions about caretaking?
Yeah.
I don't necessarily assume that because I'm entering into a relationship, I am promising to take care of someone until death do we part. And I find a greater willingness to say, we're not expecting spousal support. If we break up, we go our own ways. So there is a very different sense of what does it mean to be married that most sociologists say is something that straight marriages are actually also dealing with. And what's different is that the same-sex marriages deal with it more openly. In the straight marital community, somehow it's seen as deviant if you have a prenup with no alimony or if you have an open marriage. So in some senses, the gays and lesbians are simply doing openly what the straight couples are really doing, just not so openly.
Well, you run the risk, I guess, here of running into the religious rights criticism that we're, you know, going to destroy marriage or water it down or do something else. But, I mean, I think implicit in what you're saying, too, is we're in a place of destigmatizing the fact that many relationships do dissolve, aren't exclusive, take different forms, have different expectations. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because trying to live in denial of that fact is what really screws people up.
I would say that allowing same-sex couples to marry, first of all, extends the scope of marriage to include a greater number of people. And to the extent that more than 50% now of all kids are raised in non-traditional families, I think what we are doing is strengthening modern marriages which already are no longer traditional marriages.
Yeah. Well, if I may ask, noting that you've been in a relationship, in a partnership for 27 years, how have you navigated that path?
Well, we are actually happily and openly unmarried.
Okay.
My partner and I just celebrated our 27th anniversary of being unmarried, last Sunday, in fact. And we're unmarried in part because my partner is a retired federal employee, and therefore I can't get any of his benefits. So there's no upside to me. If there were federal recognition, you know, I'm paying $550 a month for health insurance, which I could get basically for free if we had federal recognition. That might tip the balance. So from a practical point of view, it doesn't help me to get married. We also, after many, 20 years of not being eligible for marriage, we have arranged our finances and then our property and all of those issues as an unmarried couple. And frankly, if we got married, we would have to actually undo our agreements and do new ones to balance for that. And because of our particular situation, I'm a high earner, my partner is retired, we would have some significant tax problems would we marry. And then the third, which really is personal to us, which is that we prefer the open texturedness and separate identities of being unmarried. My partner was married actually to a woman for 12 years, and we both actually prefer to be together unmarried. And one of the things that led me to talk about this openly, because I normally don't talk about myself, is I want people to see that marriage is not required for longevity.
Yeah. Again, to take that beautiful example of Dylan Phyllis getting married, you don't want to take away any of the meaning and understandable emotional attachment people have to that moment, but it's not the only path.
Yes, we had a 25th anniversary party, and what I now say to people is we don't do weddings, we do anniversary parties.
Mm.
And so to us, that's how we celebrate our relationship, not in a wedding.
Again, we're speaking with Frederick Kurtz. He's the author of Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, and Civil Unions. We'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment here on Forward Forum.
Welcome back to Forward Forum. John Quinlan here, our special Pride Weekend taped edition of the show, and we hope you'll enjoy our fascinating guest.
And welcome back to Forward Forum. Again, we're speaking with Frederick Kurtz. He is the co-author with Emily Daskow of Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, Civil Unions, and he joins us on the phone from Oakland. It's got to be frustrating sometimes for a lot of the folks that you deal with as his clients. Again, this patchwork quilt of regulations, things constantly changing. I think you were telling me on the break, just sort of being overwhelmed by the complexity of it all. How do you counsel folks in terms of putting that all in perspective?
Well, one of the things I have to point out to people is that it's complicated because of homophobia. This is very different. If someone comes to my office and says, I want to open up a business in 30 countries, they've got complicated legal problems, but they've chosen those problems. The current complexities have to do with the homophobia of the federal government in different states. So the first thing I do is say to people, okay, let's acknowledge why this is complicated. The other thing I do is explain to them, 20 years ago, your life would have been really simple. You would have had no rights. 20 years from now, I hope your life is equally simple because you have all the rights. But during this transition time, we can't put our lives on hold. We can't say no love, no death, no marriage, no divorce, no kids. We have to live our lives. And so what I say to people is, yes, it's complicated. I will try to make it simpler for you. But if you want to have a full and satisfying family life during this difficult time and this time of transition, it requires a degree of education and conscientiousness that your straight friends don't have to deal with. I would love it if all the straight lawyers and married people would acknowledge how hard it is for us and how complicated it is, have a little compassion here, but not be scared off by the complexity to make bad decisions. So that's actually the whole purpose of the book, is to both give information, but more than information, give a kind of hug and nurturing support so that people can actually take the information and make prudent decisions.
You know, what I extract out of what you're saying there, too, is that in a world where everybody's telling us, again, that we're destructive of family, that we're doing these negative things, everything that you're talking about in terms of the perseverance and the creativity that goes into strengthening our relationships is something that totally counters that says, hey.
Totally.
Yeah. We have our act together here. We really know what we're doing, and our relationships mean something substantial.
I have often said, and actually a lot of therapists and sociologists agree, that the family formation process that lesbian and gay couples go through really leads to strong, open, emotionally open, and deeper understood and deeper felt connections. And I get told over and over again, your next book needs to be for straight married couples, talking about what you've learned working with same-sex couples, because a lot of these lessons, there are a lot of straight couples that could learn from them as well.
Oh, absolutely. We've alluded to, especially in that history, you know, how the fact of children in our lives has come to all
yes.
of us. But could you just reflect briefly on how that intersects with issues?
Well, what's really crucial here is that in most states now, there is some way that both parents can become legal parents. Mm-hmm. But if you are, and it's important that you take advantage of those things, whether it's through guardianship nomination or a second parent adoption. If you live in a state that has total non-recognition of second parent rights, you can do a private agreement. I encourage people to do it. It actually helps, even if it's not legally enforceable, because, in fact, most people honor their agreements. But it's really important to be aware of what are the limitations of parentage rights so that if there is a dissolution or a death, you can, for the sake of the kids, maintain your sense of family, even if the couple breaks up.
Again, we refer people back to the book for more of the specifics. As we close out, about 3.5 minutes left here, though, could you tell people a little bit more about some of the resources, some of the framework that the book establishes for these questions?
Sure. So the book is a background on what does it mean to be married. It is a guide on how to make the decisions given your own particular life, with special attention to avoiding breakup problems and how to deal with death issues. That we also do have in each chapter a discussion of what to do if you decide not to get married. What is the legal safety net you need to create for yourselves in that option? And then recognizing that the law is changing constantly in this area, we have a website, makingitlegal.net. There's a NOLO update section that the book will link you into. And so after you've read the book, you can go onto these websites and learn how things have changed since the book was published. We also will be coming out with a new edition every year so that next year's edition will cover the latest changes. So we really encourage people to take on this educational chore. It does seem a little unromantic at times, but it's a kind of self-protection that I think will strengthen your relationship, not weaken it.
As we close out the last couple of minutes, just to ask you, where do you see things, say, a decade or two from now? Are things moving forward?
Yes. I actually do think that within the next, I'm going to say, 5 to 10 years, I think there will be full legal marriage in just about every state in the country. And I really do believe we will have federal recognition. I don't think, frankly, even the national economy, whether it's Chase Bank or Smith Barney or Bank of America credit card, I don't think they can endure this patchwork of different laws in different states any more than same-sex couples can. And I think that as it becomes more the norm, including in states like Iowa and New Hampshire, which have not been thought of as particularly progressive states, I think as it becomes more the norm and people see that, for example, in Massachusetts now, we're 5 years into marriage, heterosexual marriage has not fallen apart, and as the electorate is made up more and more of a younger demographic, I think we're going to see full marriage nationally. But it's going to be another 5 or 10 years, and if you happen to have things go wrong or get complicated in your life, in between those times, you're going to need the private arrangements and the safety nets that are talked about in the book.
All right. Again, a good way to keep on top of all of those developments these next 5 to 10 years is to follow it through this great book, Making It Legal, A Guide to Same-Sex Marriage, Domestic Partnerships, Civil Unions. As our guest Fred Hertz was just mentioning, it's going to be updated throughout. Some great web resources, other ways to keep in touch. Fred Hertz, thanks so much for joining us in Forward Forum this week.
Thank you, John, for all your insightful questions.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
And this has been Forward Forum. And if you have questions or comments to share, please write to us at forwardforum@aol.com or feel free to leave a message on our blog at forwardforumexchange.blogspot.com. Again, that's forwardforumexchange.blogspot.com. Take care, happy Pride, and have a great week.